The Iranian president says Tehran seeks to develop relations with countries like Cuba that stand against successive demands of global arrogance. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says results of the country's parliamentary elections show people support the resistance. And the UN Secretary General warns about years of mass hunger and famine as the war in Ukraine worsens the global food crisis. Hello, everyone. A very warm welcome to World News. Now, the Iranian president has described Iran-Cuba relations as strategic, saying that there are various grounds for all-out expansion of the two countries' ties. Ebrahim Raisi made the remarks in a meeting with Cuba's Deputy Prime Minister, Ricardo Cabrisas. Raisi said that Tehran is bent on developing relations with independent nations like Cuba that stand against excessive demands of global arrogance. The Iranian president described Tehran-Havana relations as positive and constructive. He added that the two countries can boost cooperation in areas such as trade, economy, agriculture, and healthcare. For his part, Cabrisas said the strategic relations between the two sides can further expand through short and long-term plans. Iran and Cuba have both, for years, been under U.S. sanctions. The United Nations envoy on the impacts of sanctions has wrapped up her 10-day visit to Iran. Her trip was aimed at assessing the human rights violations caused by the United States sanctions on the country. Our correspondent, Yusuf Jalali, reports.
Witness to the humanitarian consequences of U.S. sanctions on Iran. Alina Duhan is the U.N. Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of the unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. On her 10-day trip to Iran, she paid a visit to 30 ministries and institutions to assess how the U.S. sanctions have affected different sectors in Iran. She described the sanctions on Iran as devastating and inhumane.
Economic challenges arising from unilateral sanctions and lack of international cooperation based on shared responsibility prevent the government of Iran from providing sustainable assistance to the most vulnerable categories of population.
The UN rapporteur spoke about her observations in Iran, saying the Iranian people are bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The darkest part of all that is the fact that all population of the country, regardless of the nationality, is affected by the use of sanctions, even the nationals of countries which impose sanctions. And Iranians abroad are affected. And I believe it's even worse that imposition of these comprehensive sanctions delivers the feeling of fear.
To many Iranian patients, sanctions are an unending nightmare, barring them from accessing life-saving medicine. Hundreds of thalassemia patients and people with EB, among others, are grappling with drug shortage in Iran. Many of them have died because of this problem.
Well, the United States argues that its sanctions do not target Iran's health sector directly. But the sanctions on its banking system have made it complicated for the country to purchase medical items. Does this amount to an escape route for the U.S. to shrug off its responsibility over the existing problem in Iran's health sector?
I see here two problems. So point number one, that when it comes to the banking sector, there are no proofs that they are legal. Basically, they are illegal. There are no grounds to impose these sanctions, and it's already a problem by itself. And the humanitarian impact of banking sector sanctions has been illustrated in the report and will be illustrated in more details. When it comes to the health sector, naturally there is a general license issued by OFAC entitling for humanitarian exceptions in the health area. However, in reality, it's nearly not possible. It's not possible because of the number of issues. The very first one to deliver humanitarian goods, you still need to get OFAC license in many of the cases. And getting OFAC license is very lengthy. You need to consult lawyers or people who used to deal with OFAC license. Responses come within several years.
Alina Duhan started her mandate as a UN rapporteur in March 2020. Ever since, she has paid similar visits to four other countries, including Zimbabwe and Venezuela. UN rapporteurs are appointed by the UN as freelancers and are not affiliated to and paid by the UN. That's why Ms. Duhan promised that her report will not be influenced by politics.
Ms. Duhan cited countless instances of the humanitarian side effects of U.S. sanctions on Iran, dismissing the move as a tool to achieve political gains.
Tehran now views Ms. Dehan as an independent and internationally endorsed witness to the issue, urging her to report it as it is to the UN Human Rights Council. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement has hailed the results of the country's parliamentary elections as a great victory for the resistance front. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said the gains of Hezbollah and its allies in the elections shows people support the resistance and want it to keep its weapons. He also praised the Lebanese people for their massive participation in the electoral process despite economic, social, and political upheaval in the country. Nasrallah said the voters' enthusiasm and turnout show they didn't care about 3 years of campaign to boycott the vote. Hezbollah and its allies have won 62 seats in the 128-member assembly. 13 seats have also gone to independent candidates who have yet to choose a bloc. The political bureau chief of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, has warned that any attempt by Israel to assassinate resistance leaders will lead to all-out conflict in the region. Ismail Haniyeh issued the warning in letters sent to leaders of many regional countries. According to his media advisor, Haniyeh urged the countries to warn the Israeli regime and its leaders against returning to its assassination policy. He stressed the regime will pay an unexpected price if it goes ahead with its plan. That after Israeli media recently cited senior military sources as saying that the assassination of top Hamas officials is an option. Reports said that Hamas leader in the Gaza Strip, Yahya Sinwar, and Mohammed Deif, commander of the group's military wing, the Qassam Brigades, are the obvious targets. And earlier, our Gaza correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, joined us with more on the Israeli threats to assassinate senior Hamas officials. Here he is.
Some analysts believe that the reason for such threats is that the so-called coalition government within the Israeli regime is fragile, and possibly the Israeli prime minister trying to garner support from other members of his government and the Israeli Knesset by making threats against Palestinian resistance factions, especially that we saw over the last few weeks an increase in resistance operations within the Israeli regime. The Israeli regime trying to scapegoat the resistance factions by blaming them for carrying such attacks. They mainly blame Hamas's leader in Gaza, Yahya al-Sinwar, who during the last days of the holy month of Ramadan called on all Palestinians within occupied historical land of Palestine to use all forms of resistance against the Israeli forces, whether it's knives or axes or anything that they have available against Israeli soldiers and police.
Now, for the first time, Russia has fired missiles from its S-300 defense systems in Syria to target Israeli warplanes. This may signal a shift in Russia's relationship with Israel when it comes to Syria and, by default, towards Iran's interests in Syria. Real question now is whether Israel is going to continue bombing Syria, even though it risks getting hit by Russian missiles.
Tensions between Russia and Israel appear to be on the rise. Israeli media reports say Russian forces have opened fire on Israeli jets with advanced S-300 anti-aircraft missiles. The missiles were fired at Israeli warplanes after they attacked targets in northwestern Syria. The move is seen as a sign of significant shift in Moscow's attitude toward Israel. The unprecedented incident is set to have occurred on Friday night when Israeli jets targeted an area near the city of Masyaf, which killed several people. Israel's airstrikes on targets in Syria are countered by the country's anti-aircraft missile batteries. But this time, however, the S-300 batteries also opened fire as the jets were departing the area.
It is the case that these missiles, the S-300 battery, is operated by Russian military personnel, and that they would not have fired without permission from senior commanders. Okay, this is a break in the normal procedure.
Syria's S-300 batteries are operated by Russian military and cannot be fired without their approval. Israeli media reports claim the S-300 radar did not manage to lock onto the Israeli jets and thus did not present a serious threat to the fighter jets. But this would mark the first use of the S-300s against the Israeli warplanes over Syria. It's not clear whether the S-300 missile fire was a one-time event or if it was a Russian signal to Israel that it was changing its policy.
So this was the first use of it, and it was known to be done by Russian military personnel at Russian military command. But it also, they did not lock the radar on the planes. So the planes were never in danger. It's unclear from the reports whether they couldn't lock the radar on the planes or whether they just didn't lock them and just wanted to throw these missiles up there as a kind of signal and a warning to Israel that, you know, we may change our policy and we may take down some planes.
Now, Israel is believed to have conducted hundreds of missile strikes on Syria. It claims that it's targeting Iranian sites and weapons meant for Hezbollah in Lebanon. But Iran is present on Syrian soil and with the invitation from the Syrian government. Meantime, the Israeli bombardments, that is, continue to claim both civilian and military lives.
The development comes amid deteriorating relations between Tel Aviv and Moscow over Ukraine. Israel has backed Ukraine after the war began. Tel Aviv's stance has angered Russia. Russia's latest move against Israel would be a worrying development for Israel.
And that has to do, of course, with the whole reverberations of what's going on with Ukraine. And, you know, the Russians are realizing that and starting to act much more militantly, in the sense that they understand this is now a war for the future of a lot of things.
The Tel Aviv regime has repeatedly targeted the positions of the Syrian army and its allies, but has rarely acknowledged or discussed such operations. The aerial bombardment intensified in scale and frequency after 2011, when the Arab country found itself in the grip of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism.
Oh, it will continue. No question about it. Look, it's not going to even think about stopping until a plane goes down. If S-300s or some other effective anti-aircraft defense takes down Israeli planes, then there'll be a problem. So the Russians have signaled something here, and they didn't take down a plane. And until and unless they do, Israel's not going to change its policy on that at all. And even if they do, that would cause a problem for Israel, and they would have to think twice about it.
Damascus says Tel Aviv carries out attacks on the Arab country to aid terrorist groups against the Syrian army. It has repeatedly complained to the United Nations, calling the aggression a blatant violation of the country's sovereignty and international law. The development comes after warmongering rhetoric of Israeli officials against Iran and its allies. Just recently, Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said Tel Aviv would prevent Iran from transferring advanced capabilities to its allies in the region. But Iran has dismissed the threat, saying it's determined to help the resistance axis stand up against Israel's aggressive moves in the region.
UK-based pro-Palestine activist group has taken the fight to Israel's biggest arms manufacturer in Britain by launching a series of direct action protests at sites belonging to drone producer Elbit Systems. Palestine Action vowed further action in response to ongoing support that Elbit provides the Israeli regime in oppressing innocent Palestinians. Robert Carter has your story.
A UK-based Israeli arms manufacturer has been hit with a series of disruptive direct action protests in retaliation to recent Israeli aggression against Palestinians. Palestine Action have intensified their long-running campaign against Elbit Systems, with activists trashing sites in London and Bristol.
Elbit Systems is a notorious Israeli arms manufacturer with locations dotted all across the UK. Their HQ, located just behind me, is a popular target for Palestine Action, who claim that their activities is focused on disrupting their production activities. Elbit is known for producing up to 85% of Israel's drone fleet, after all.
Israeli crimes against Palestinians has circulated world headlines in recent weeks, particularly surrounding the killing of journalist Shireen Abu Akhila, shot dead by Israeli regime forces as she documented an Israeli assault on a Palestinian refugee camp on the 11th of May. The killing occurred just days before the Nakba, an annual date which marks the ethnic cleansing of native Palestinians from their homeland. Elbit's recent response stated,
Elbit Systems UK is proud to provide advanced support for the UK armed forces. Attempting to disrupt this work during a time of heightened global instability is dangerous and highly irresponsible.
However, speaking to Press TV, the activists rubbish Elbit's stance.
How many lives have they saved compared to how many lives they've taken? Would be my question. They are responsible for so many deaths of men, women and children. How could you possibly think that that's in any way security? It's illegal, it's a crime. All of these things are criminal, and yet it's when you're out there doing something that you're shown as the criminal, essentially. And I've always found that very interesting as a narrative.
With Palestine action vowing to continue and Israel's occupation persisting, many expect to see more spilling of red paint, but also more Palestinian blood too. Robert Carter, London.
The UN Secretary General has warned about years of mass hunger and famine if no steps are taken to contain a global food crisis worsened by the war in Ukraine.
Russia must permit the safe and secure export of grain stored in Ukrainian ports. Alternative transportation routes can be explored, even if we know that by itself they will not be enough to solve the problem. And Russian food and fertilizers must have unrestricted access to world markets without indirect impediments. I have been in intense contact on this issue at the senior leadership level with the Russian Federation, Ukraine, Turkey, the United States, the European Union, and several other key countries. I am hopeful, but there is still a long way to go. The complex security, economic, and financial implications require goodwill on all sides for a package deal to be reached.
Antonio Guterres was addressing a food security meeting at the United Nations. He said the war in Ukraine is compounding global food insecurity amid warming temperatures and the coronavirus pandemic. The UN chief said the number of severely food insecure people has doubled from 135 million to 276 million in just 2 years. Guterres said the war in Ukraine threatens to tip tens of millions of people over the edge into food insecurity. War and economic sanctions on Russia have increased global prices for food and fuel, especially in developing countries. Russia and Ukraine account for nearly a third of global wheat supplies. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Just 2 weeks before the Zionist regime forces assassinated Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aghele, the International Federation of Journalists, the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate, and the International Center of Justice for Palestinians had submitted a formal complaint to the International Criminal Court accusing the Zionist regime of systematically targeting Palestinian journalists. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Marjorie Khan, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Journalists Accuse the Israeli Regime of Targeting Them 2 weeks before killing of Abu Aghele. Stay tuned for more. Just 2 weeks before the Zionist regime forces assassinated Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aghla, the International Federation of Journalists, the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate, and the International Center of Justice for Palestinians had submitted a formal complaint to the International Criminal Court accusing the Israeli regime of systematically targeting Palestinian journalists. The targeting of journalists and media organizations in Palestine violates the right to life and freedom of expression, said Anthony Belanger, the General Secretary of the International Federation of Journalists. In a moment when the Zionist regime propaganda machine is working hard to keep mainstream news organizations mired in reporting on the Zionist regime efforts to raise questions about who shot the bullet that killed Abu Aghla, we must insist on understanding her killing within the broader and ongoing context of the Zionist regime's violence against Palestinian journalists. It was revealing that the Zionist regime's military spokesperson described Shirin and her colleague, Ali Al-Samoudi, who was shot in the back, as being armed with cameras. If you will permit me to say that, writes James Zogby in The Nation. That is what good journalists do. They arm themselves with cameras and laptops. They witness events as they happen and tell stories so that readers and viewers can understand the human drama that is unfolding. It appears that Israel finds this profoundly, even existentially threatening. Why else would they have killed dozens of Palestinian journalists in the past 2 decades? It was perhaps no accident that the Zionist regime targeted Abu Aghla on May 11th, 4 days before Palestinians commemorated the 74-year anniversary of the Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe. On May 15th, Palestinians mourned the violent founding of the fabricated regime of Israel on Palestinian land. For 25 years, Abu Aghla had documented the Zionist regime's war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territory for Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera reported Abu Aghla herself embodied Palestinian humanity by speaking truth to power. She was covering an arrest operation by the Zionist regime forces near the entrance to the Jenin refugee camp when she was assassinated. Although she was wearing a flak vest marked press, an Israeli regime military sniper shot her below the ear. The only part of her head not covered by her protective helmet, clearly evidencing an intent to kill. Al Jazeera journalist Shata Hanaisha, also wearing a helmet and vest labeled as press, tried to reach Abu Aghla, but the Zionist regime troops did not stop firing even after she collapsed, she said. I couldn't even extend my arm to pull her because of the shots. The army was adamant on shooting to kill. Ali Al-Samoudi, another journalist with Al Jazeera, who was also wearing a press vest, was shot in the back while covering the same event as Abu Aghla. He survived and is being treated for his wounds. Thousands of mourners came out to honor Abu Aghla. To add insult to injury, as her casket was being carried through the streets, the Zionist regime occupation forces attacked them, beating and kicking the mourners, then forcing pallbearers to nearby drop the coffin. Now the occupying power has spoken back by shooting her in the head and attacking her mourners, a response that can only be classified as acute and multi-eared state savagery. In keeping with Israelis' modus operandi of refusing to let Palestinians live, die, or be buried in peace, writes Belen Fernandez at Al Jazeera. Assassinations or extrajudicial executions constitute war crimes under the Geneva Conventions. On March 3, 2021, Fatou Bensouda, the former ICC chief prosecutor, had announced that the ICC was mounting an investigation into war crimes committed in the West Bank, including East Al-Quds and the Gaza Strip, since the Zionist regime's 2014 Operation Protective Edge, during which the Zionist regime forces killed 2,251 Palestinians. Bensouda found a reasonable basis to believe that the Zionist regime forces committed war crimes, including willful killing, willfully causing serious injury, disproportionate use of force, and the transfer of Israelis into Palestinian territories. Bensouda also determined there was a reasonable basis to investigate war crimes, including intentional attacks against civilians using civilians as human shields and torture and willful killing by the Zionist regime forces. In October 2021, the Zionist regime designated six Palestinian human rights groups as terrorist organizations with absolutely no evidence. This was done in retaliation for their support of the ICC investigation and the boycott, divestment and sanctions, or BDS movement. The BDS movement was launched by 170 Palestinian civil society organizations in 2005. It called for boycott, divestment, and sanctions described as non-violent punitive measures that will last until the Zionist regime complies fully with international law by, first, ending its occupation and colonization of all Arab lands and dismantling its barrier wall, 85% of which is on Palestinian land. Two, recognizing the fundamental rights of Arab Palestinian citizens in occupied territories to full equality. And three, respecting, promoting, and protecting the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their land as mandated by United Nations General Assembly Resolution 194. The killing of Abu Aqile has led to calls for an independent, impartial investigation and galvanized opposition to the Zionist regime's illegal occupation of Palestine. On May 13th, UN human rights experts condemned Abu Aqile's killing, saying it is part of a continuation of the high rate of attacks against media workers, particularly Palestinian journalists. More than 40 Palestinian journalists have reportedly been killed since 2000, with hundreds injured or targeted for violence. The UN experts included four special rapporteurs. One, on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territory occupied since 1967. Two, on the extrajudicial summary or arbitrary executions. Three, on violence against women, its causes and consequences. And four, on the promotion and protection of the right to freedom of opinion and expression. They said Abu Aqile's killing may amount to a war crime and demanded a prompt, independent, impartial, effective, thorough, and transparent investigation. Authorities have an obligation not to harm journalists and to protect them from harm under international humanitarian law and international human rights law, the rapporteurs noted. They added that the targeting of journalists working in the occupied Palestinian territory and the Zionist regime's failure to properly investigate killings of media personnel violate the rights to life and to effective remedies. Decrying the litany of extrajudicial executions, they said the safety of journalists is crucial to guaranteeing the rights to freedom of expression and media freedom. Noting that 2021 marked the highest number of Palestinian deaths since the Zionist regime's 2014 Operation Protective Edge, the experts declared, "The unsustainable situation is inherent to the extent of protracted military occupation in which violence and repression are used to perpetuate a system of Palestinian subjugation. They call for dismantlement of the occupation, including the Gaza blockade and the illegal settlements in the West Bank and East Al-Quds." More than 6,000 people have signed a statement initiated by the anti-war and anti-imperialist group Code Pink, calling for a thorough and impartial investigation of Abu Aghili's killing and the immediate suspension of the United States military aid to the fabricated regime of Israel. The U.S. enables the Israeli war crimes and its illegal occupation by providing it with $3.8 billion in unconditional military assistance annually, in spite of the classification of Israel as an apartheid regime by leading human rights organizations, including Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and the Israeli group B'Tselem. The Palestinian BDS National Committee, BNC, said Abu Aghili's killing amounts to war crime, a willful killing under the ICC's Rome Statute. BNC called for accountability for the perpetrators, those who gave the orders, and the entire political leadership of apartheid Israel. Though Israel killed Shirin Abu Aghili, her blood is also on the hands of the enablers, funders, and defenders of apartheid, primarily the US, EU, UK, Canada, and Australia. BNC noted in a statement, adding, "We call for public BDS pressure to end the West colonial hypocrisy and shameless complicity in the Zionist regime crimes and ongoing Nakba against indigenous Palestinians." BNC condemned the Western indifference to Palestinians, which enables the Zionist regime's impunity, directly contributing to ongoing Nakba. "We reiterate our call for meaningful solidarity with Palestinians facing ethnic cleansing, massacres, colonial dispossession, and apartheid," BNC noted. Moreover, BNC cited the hypocrisy in contrasting responses of the West to human rights violations against Palestine. BNC recommends that people strategically channel their anger by working with progressive networks to pressure governments and parliaments to end military security cooperation trade with apartheid Israel, ban all goods and services in the Zionist regime's illegal settlements, stop material support for pillaged and disputed Israeli fracked gas, and demand a UN investigation of Israeli apartheid.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends, and here is food for thought for you today in the form of a beautiful saying from the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him. Exchange visits, treat each other mercifully, give each other, and do not be like the hypocrites who say what they do not do.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Babul Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim عليه السلام. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kadhim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: التودد إلى الناس نصف العقل.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, affection towards people is half of intellect.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. In the beautiful dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam with his companions, we find that in response to how we should supplicate to Allah, what we should say to Allah, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam speaks about this idea, and he teaches certain du'as, certain dialogues, certain forms and manners of communication to his companions on how to communicate and have a dialogue with the Almighty Allah. In one such instance, we find that Imam al-Kadhim teaches his companion to recite thus: O my protector, Allah, I have submitted to you, so do not hand me over to the enemy. I have trusted in you, so do not desert me. I have sought refuge in your vast and easy protection, so do not dismiss me. In this beautiful dua, very short, very concise, but so beautifully profound and full of spirituality and wisdom, Imam al-Kadhim addresses the Almighty Allah as, O my protector. What better protector can one have than Allah? And then how humbly does Imam al-Kadhim say, I have submitted to you, O Allah, so do not hand me over to the enemy. For surely if we submit ourselves to Allah, then we are of Allah. We are now the property of Allah. We are under the care and protection of Allah. So why would Allah hand us over to the enemy? And Imam Al-Kadhim says, I have trusted in you, O Allah. So do not desert me. If we trust Allah, how is it possible that Allah will leave us alone, will leave us isolated, will leave us lonely, will desert us? And that too, at the times when we need Allah the most. And finally, Imam Al-Kadhim says, I have sought refuge in your vast and easy protection. So do not dismiss me from you. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
So Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam is saying there are two hujjat. One is that aql, which is daruni, which is in us, that we have. And then there is aql, which is outside, which is the hujjat of God, which is the proof of God. Because there is a possibility of the internal aql being influenced from outside. The internal aql making an error. If that internal aql makes an error, then you have the imam outside. Because that is why qiyas in our school of thought is not considered as a valid methodology in jurisprudence. So therefore, qiyas is your opinion, your intellectual calculation, but there is hujjat which is outside. Yes, aql is one of the hujjat. From those four, you have the kitab, you have the sunnah, you have the taqreer-e-masum, qawl-e-masum, you have the Quran, right? And then aql as well, and consensus, which is the ijma. So aql is one of them that is there. But if this aql goes against the hujjat, it is not accepted. So you have the aql-e-daruni, you have the aql which is internal aql, then you have the aql which is outside. And both of them needs to be in harmony for reaching or for that plight towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The emphasis on intellect, the emphasis on knowledge, the emphasis on mannerism, on adab, that's what Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, the imams, promoted and showed in their akhlaq, in their behavior, and approach things. That's why, imam is known as Kazim, who controlled that, who had hilm, which is one of the qualities of God, who had hilm. And at the same time, the empathy that the imam had, where he took the suffering of his own self, so that others may not suffer.
Listening to this episode of Dialogue, don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Cultural news. Social news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With the light.
Tehran is hosting the 33rd International Book Fair in person for the first time after 2 years of lockdown as a result of COVID-19. This has caused enthusiasts to visit the fair for new titles. Saman Kujuri has the story.
The 33rd Tehran International Book Fair is underway in the Iranian capital, with over 1,700 Iranian as well as 170 foreign publishers attending the event. It is the first time after 2 years of lockdown as a result of the COVID-19 that the Tehran International Book Fair is being held both in person and online. As the top Iranian book event, the fair has millions of visitors every year, including thousands of university students, scholars, and their families.
I'm very happy to see that the book fair has once again opened its doors to the visitors in person after 2 years of lockdown as a result of the COVID-19. I love reading books. To me, the Tehran Book Fair is my favorite event.
For me, the book fair is an opportunity to get my kids familiar with books. I try to take them to different book fairs so as to teach them that book is a necessity in our life. I want to raise my children with the love for book reading.
A huge number of national visitors, along with international exhibitors from different countries, make this event one of the unique cultural events. The book fair is a good opportunity for publishers to showcase their new products.
We have designed our educational books based on augmented reality, which is an interactive experience of a real-world environment where the objects that reside in the real world are enhanced by computer-generated perceptual information, and students can watch educational films related to any specific topic. It will help students better understand educational topics.
It is said that books give a soul to the universe, wings to the mind, flight to the imagination, and life to everything. And this is exactly what the book fair tries to help you achieve.
By reading books, we feel healthy is the motto of the 33rd edition of the Tehran International Book Fair, which will be running through May 21st at Imam Khomeini's Musalla. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
A group of over a dozen penguins has been released back to the sea after being given a second chance to live.
The condition of these specimens, which fortunately could be reinserted, is very common to find. They are animals that appear stranded on the coast, found with malnutrition, dehydration, hypothermia, and a high degree of parasitism. Specialists call this condition the stranded penguin syndrome.
The penguins were rescued and taken to the Mondo Marino Foundation, where they were rehabilitated. They were kept warm and were fed liquids until they could eat fish again. Before their release, blood and other samples were taken and a chip was implanted to track them. One of the penguins was a southern rockhopper, which is a species listed as endangered. Biologists at a rescue center say there are many reasons why penguins get stranded and malnourished. These include overfishing, global warming, and other environmental changes. Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, while winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinged through street buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacular and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You will have seen people around town at the moment. Everybody's asking, what's going on? What's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways. And that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point. And that's fun.
Daniel Bryan said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at the site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Chilean paleontologists unearthed a rare, fully intact fossil of what is known as a sea dragon discovered from a melting glacier deep in Patagonia.
It is the first complete and excavated ichthyosaur that has been found in Chile. It also corresponds to one of the most complete fossils ever found on the planet for the Cretaceous period. It is the only pregnant ichthyosaur that's been found on the planet from the era between 129 and 139 million years ago. So it's incredibly important.
The 4-meter-long fossil is nicknamed Fiona and swam the seas some 250 million years ago. Scientists say this specimen will help them understand this species and its embryonic development. The expedition lasted over a month because of the remote nature of the find in the Patagonian glaciers. Paleontologists had to make a 10-hour hike just to get to the site. They also had to camp in extreme weather conditions while maneuvering tricky, rocky surfaces. But collecting and transporting the fossil was a whole other story.
As we went down excavating, weakening the rock, we realized the skeleton was mostly complete, so much that the bones were pushed inwards and we had to make five blocks of approximately 200 kilos each to move it.
The blocks were then airlifted to the Rio Seco Natural History Museum in southern Chile to be prepared for exhibition. The fossil was first discovered by Ruth Pedro more than a decade ago, but because of the site's harsh terrain, its extraction was a complex challenge. Scientists also discovered over 20 other specimens of the same species during the expedition, bringing the total found in the glacier area to 100.
Stopping by and listening to street musicians usually changes our mood for the rest of the day. The experience would be different if one lies under the instrument while it is being played. And that's exactly what a pianist in America has done. Colin Huggins, a busker, wheels his grand piano more than a half a mile from a mini storage to New York's Washington Square Park. He lets people lie down under the instrument and feel the vibrations from the claviers in their bodies. Colin says he wants to help people recover emotionally from the intense disconnect they had faced during COVID lockdowns.
I've always wanted to accommodate feelings in the best way possible, and I want to do it with music, and this is the best way I figure out how to do it. Maybe someday I'll figure out a way to do it even better, and I won't need to push this piano here. But as of now, this is the best I've got.
New York was one of the hardest hit cities by COVID in the U.S. Like other places, the major city imposed lockdowns and tough curbs to contain the virus. Despite that, Colin continued playing on the streets, frequently to an audience of zero. He says he strongly believes that everything will be okay. Cambodian fishermen aiming for small fish were shocked to see the surprise catch tied to their hook. This creature was nothing but an endangered giant freshwater stingray, which had swallowed the fishermen's catch. It was 4 meters long and weighed 180 kilos. The female leviathan is one of the rarest species of fish in Southeast Asia. Therefore, a team of international experts helped unhook the stingray to release it back to the waters unharmed.
All right, so we've just released our giant stingray back into the wild. She's kind of hanging out on the surface of the river here. It's amazing to be able to see her swimming around in her natural habitat and to have participated in the release of this giant stingray today.
The giant stingray was caught in the Mekong River, an important habitat for different species of fish, including huge catfish and barb. However, experts say the river's underwater ecosystem has been damaged by massive plastic wastes. Environmentalists constantly warn that building dams on the Mekong River is also destroying its large fish stock.
Scaling Mount Everest is only a dream for many and a once-in-a-lifetime achievement for most professional mountaineers. Well, not for this Nepali Sherpa, who has now repeated the feat for a record 26th time. 52-year-old Kami Rita led a group of other Sherpa climbers along the traditional Southeast Ridge route to the world's tallest peak. In the process, he beat his own previous record set last year. Rita first scaled Everest in 1994 and has been making the trip nearly every year since then. The Sherpa community is an ethnic group indigenous to the Himalayan region. They are expert mountain navigators who also carry heavy loads. Everest stands nearly 9,000 meters above sea level. The mountain has been climbed more than 10,000 times since it was first scaled in 1953. The bad news is more than 300 people have died trying. Chinese scientists are establishing a meteorological monitoring station at an altitude of 8,800 meters on Mount Komolangma, the world's highest peak on the China-Nepal border. The 13 members of the research team started the trek towards an 8,300-meter base camp on Mount Komolangma from a 7,028-meter camp on Tuesday morning. They reached the camp in the afternoon and went on the last section of the arduous journey up on Wednesday morning. It replaces the one at an altitude of 8,430 meters set up by the British and U.S. scientists on the mountains in 2019.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
This hateful white nationalist rhetoric is not just being spread by lone gunmen. It can also be found on cable news and in the rhetoric of politicians today. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by John Cooley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Buffalo Gunman's Racism Directly Tied to Mainstreaming of White Nationalism, Say Critics. Here's the story. amid the outpouring